Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a pastor and community advocate on why he thinks the Phoenix police need oversight and why drought looks different on the East Coast than it does here. But first, 2024 is nearly over, and what a year in politics it was. Political cycles never really end anymore, but we're going to spend the next few minutes this morning reminiscing with our politics desk on the good, the bad, and the ugly of this historic election year here in Arizona. And for that, I'm joined by Cameron Sanchez and Wayne Shutsky, who have followed every up and down. Good morning to you both.
Hello. Hello.
Okay, so we had our fair share of ugly, and we'll get to that in Arizona politics this year. But let's start with the good. Cameron, what did you come up with here?
Well, I thought it was quite nice that we didn't have any election fraud claims this year, at least not any of the big ones that we had for the past two election cycles in Arizona, which is what we're kind of famous for, quite frankly, especially in Maricopa County. But I think maybe largely due to the fact that Republicans were so successful, it was actually quite quiet afterwards. And there was no, you know, for example, giant audit.
Yeah, we kind of expected that heading into the election, that there would be recounts, there would be really close margins, there would be some controversy.
Yeah, we were kind of braced for anything and everything that could happen. I think that, you know, especially if Trump had lost Arizona, then there would have probably been a lot more fallout. But as it stands, there was just sort of a fizzle.
Okay. Wayne, good?
The good I would look at is going back to the legislative session. Everyone probably remembers when the Supreme Court allowed the territorial era a near total abortion ban to stand, and then the legislature ultimately repealed it. Now, I'm looking at that as a good because it's kind of an example of the legislative process actually working as it's supposed to. There was definitely some ugliness and some fighting on the floor and,
yes,
and all that during the process of it happening, but ultimately, what happened is the Supreme Court said this law, despite that it might be unpopular, was never repealed. The legislature, in fact, said we're not repealing it the last time they addressed it. So it's not our job as judges to change that. And so it is in effect. A lot of people got upset about that. And then it went back to the legislature where, you know, a few Republicans, T.J. Shope, Shauna Bullock, a few others, joined Democrats to repeal it. And, you know, I say that as a good thing because, again, We had an abortion proposal on the ballot that passed with voters. So it's an example of the legislature actually apparently reflecting the will of the voters and doing the work, despite the fact that it was hard, despite the fact that it was, especially for the few Republicans that crossed the aisle, it was unpopular with a lot of their colleagues and a lot of the loudest voices down there. They were managed to get some work done that appears to reflect what the voters wanted.
Interesting. Okay. So let's move on to the bad. Wayne, what did you come up with here? What did you think was particularly bad this election cycle? And, you know, pick one or two.
Yeah. I was going to go with the overall Democratic campaign strategy. I think Democrats thought they had a really good chance to flip the legislature, at least one or two chambers, maybe get a tie somewhere. I was among those that thought at least getting a tie in the Senate was a real possibility. And as Cameron mentioned, Republicans had a banner year. You know, outside of Ruben Gallego winning a U.S. Senate seat, Republicans really dominated. They won the presidency in Arizona. They increased their margins at the state legislature.
Which no one really expected.
No. I mean, I think they thought best case for most Republicans, a lot of pundits thought was that they would keep the current majority, but they actually added a few seats. And they won contested congressional races. And going to bring it back to my first answer with the abortion topic, I think Democrats maybe overestimated the impact having that abortion rights ballot measure on would have on their chances. I think what happened was is a lot of people did turn out for that and it did pass overwhelmingly. But that didn't necessarily translate into votes for Democrats. I think there are moderate Republicans, independents, folks like that who voted for the abortion measure but didn't necessarily then go and vote for Democratic candidates.
Yeah. Okay. So, Cameron, the bad?
Well, there was an unfortunate glitch that showed up late in the election process, although before the actual election day, that showed that more than 200,000, about 218,000 voters, you know, had been caught up in this thing with their designate or their documented proof of citizenship. And so there was a kerfuffle about how are we going to address that before the election? Do we have to find a way to prove that all of these people are Arizona residents, are citizens, and it went to court and it was sort of a flurry. So that's definitely a bad thing because it still has to be addressed. And there was a group that sued to get the names and information of those people, which the Secretary of State fought against out of concern about what was going to happen with that information.
Yeah.
And it was eventually released. And so now it starts the process of presumably before the next election, tracking down those people and figuring out, you know, are they Arizona citizens who should be able to vote? And they were allowed to vote, mm-hmm. which was probably the most convenient thing that could have happened. But that was an unfortunate mess to happen right before the election.
And yeah, this was a huge deal and could have been incredibly consequential, right?
Yes, it could have been. I mean, if those people hadn't been allowed to vote, 218,000, like that's a giant population in a swing state like Arizona, it could have changed the outcomes of plenty of races.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get to my favorite here, probably yours as well. Let's talk about what was a little ugly in Arizona politics this year. I can think of some examples for sure, but let's start with you here, Cameron.
I think it's fair to say that it was fairly ugly when Carrie Lake revealed that, you know, DeWitt had asked her to not run.
This was at the time, the head of the state GOP.
Yeah, so she never said that it was her who did it, but somebody recorded a conversation between them. He doesn't seem to know that he was being recorded, where he was like, you know, we really don't want you to run. Please do something else with your time. Kind of trying to tell her that she shouldn't be the candidate. And, you know, she or someone released that. And then Jeff DeWitt got ousted as the head of the Republican Party. And as a result, they had to pick a new one. But it was sort of chaotic, messy time with the Republicans and who's going to be in charge of this and what do we think of that? And was it, you know, right for that recording to be released at all? Or is it the best thing for transparency, et cetera?
Nothing like a secret recording for a little politics. Okay, Wayne, what you got under ugly here?
Well, I'm going to go back to the state legislature. We saw a few ethics complaints this year. We saw, despite, as I mentioned, some examples of the legislative process working, there was also a lot of infighting, a lot of squabbling going on. We had, at the beginning of the year, Democrat Representative Lisa Sun resigning after she had an ethics complaint filed against her because she allegedly had threatened to throw a lobbyist off a balcony, she says in jest, at a hotel meeting down in Tucson. There was an ethics hearing filed. Actually, Democrats brought the ethics complaint against her mm-hmm. over the allegations. She's a Democrat as
well. Her own party, yeah.
Yeah, and then she basically resigned before they were about to take a vote to kick her out. So that was not maybe the best look for the legislature. There were other ethics complaints related to the actual abortion repeal debate. Some Democrats had gone on the floor and started yelling shame at their Republican colleagues as they blocked some efforts to repeal that abortion law before it eventually was repealed.
Yeah.
You know, some Game of Thrones type of imagery there.
It got intense.
And then again, ethics complaints arising that people felt unsafe on the floor. And so despite the fact that ultimately led to a legislative process that worked, it, you know, there was some ugliness there and fighting over other contentious topics at the Capitol where we saw kind of people either muttering things under their breath at other colleagues or openly yelling at other colleagues. There was a lot of examples down there of people maybe not getting along or following the rules of decorum, as some of the legislators like to remind us, that are supposed to be observed down there.
Yeah. Okay. So very quickly, last question for you both. Let's end on at least a forward-looking note here. What are you each looking forward to most in 2025? Like, we will have a new administration in Washington, an even stronger Republican majority in the state ledge. What issues do you anticipate talking a lot about next year?
The end of the legislative session. And I say that in jest, but since I've started covering the Capitol over the past few years, legislative sessions have stretched in like to their breaking point, essentially, mm-hmm. like the end of June when they have to pass a budget. And that wasn't the norm. Like, the legislative session is supposed to end earlier in the year, get things done and get these people home. And so I'm actually interested to see whether the increased Republican majority and the friction with the governor's office increases that, or actually we go to June again.
Yeah. All right. We will have to leave it there for now. That is KJZZ's politics desk, Wade Chutsky, Cameron Sanchez. Thank you both. I appreciate it as always.
Yeah, thank you.
This week on the show, we're presenting a mini-series about the backstory of the volatile debate around immigration policy. Today, we bring you our second installment. During the presidential election, Vice President Kamala Harris was heavily scrutinized for her role in addressing the so-called root causes of the surge of migrants at the southern border. But while there was plenty of arguing about what the vice president actually did, there was far less conversation about what those root causes are. Thankfully, in his new book, Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here, Jonathan Blitzer tells that story in expansive detail. From the 1980s to the early 2000s, he writes, migrants entering the U.S. via Mexico tended to be single Mexican men, many of them looking for work. But around 2014, a different population started to arrive on a scale Americans had never seen before. These were children and families from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, the so-called Northern Triangle of Central America. They weren't looking for work. They were risking their lives to escape brutal regimes in their home countries, coming to the U.S. to seek political asylum. At this point, what Blitzer calls two inescapable realities collided. Living conditions in Central America had gotten so bad that many people couldn't remain even if they wanted. And the U.S. immigration system was capable only of, quote, flailing triage. In attempting to explain a vast, multi-pronged crisis, Blitzer's book unfolds as a series of character studies. And when he spoke to the show's Sam Dingman, they began with a harrowing scene involving one of the principal figures in the story, a Salvadoran doctor named Juan Ramagoza. In the 1980s, at the height of the Salvadoran Civil War, and Ramagoza is training to be a surgeon at a hospital in El Salvador. A badly wounded student protester is brought in after being shot by the police, and Ramagoza and his colleagues perform emergency surgery. Blitzer picks up the story from there.
You know, it's late at night, maybe 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and Juan is sort of drifting off next to his patient's bed. His job is to sort of monitor the patient's progress. And all of a sudden, he hears the marching of soldiers' boots down this long hallway in the hospital. And before he realizes it, the door swings open, and a handful of armed men order everyone to hit the ground and walk right up to the bed where this patient is recovering and fire a number of bullets into him and kill him. And Juan is stuck under the bed watching as these bullet casings are pinging off the floor. And that was very much a common occurrence in 1980s era El Salvador. And one of the reasons why so many people eventually were forced to flee because of the continued persecution and repression.
So that scene, it doesn't just help to illustrate the kind of authoritarianism that might prompt someone to want to leave a country to seek asylum in the United States. It also lays the groundwork for another very harrowing layer to this story, which is that many of those authoritarian regimes have been propped up by the United States.
Yeah, you know, it's hard in retrospect to overstate the force of the sort of geopolitical orthodoxy at the time, which was that the United States was engaged in a cold war against the spread of leftism and communism in the region. And as a result, the United States not only had allies with right-wing regimes across the region that vowed to crack down on communists or leftist insurgents, but actually the U.S. fully armed a lot of these regimes, gave them military training, gave them diplomatic cover. And the overall effect of all of this in the 1980s was that you had huge numbers of people who had no choice but to flee the country because they were being persecuted. And when they reached the United States, the U.S. had finally actually created the legal infrastructure of what became the asylum system. But there was very little thought given to this kind of circumstance, the circumstance of large numbers of people showing up at the southern border and saying, look, we're here to present a legal claim to asylum. The U.S. government didn't have the space to hold people while they took their initial interviews. They just didn't have the infrastructure in any sense. And that, of course, detonated a big political crisis that really made it even harder for policymakers to do the right sorts of things to start to ease the administrative burden of all of this.
Well, this makes me think about something that I heard you say in an interview that I would love to ask you to expand on a little bit. You said, quote, "The policy levers don't match the lived experience of people who make the journey."
Yeah, let me give you the most concrete example I can think of, which is the story of a Honduran mother who in 2017 Before the Trump era family separation policy was fully known or even fully fleshed out, there was a pilot program. And so this hunter and mother, Keldy, she came with her two children. They were separated at the southern border. Keldy was detained for over a year and eventually deported. And so there was a moment a couple of years later where I found myself with Keldy and a number of other Honduran migrants at this particular moment in time in southern Mexico, making the journey again. And on the one hand, you'd think, okay, well, the logic of this enforcement policy was precisely that it was meant to discourage people from trying to attempt this trip again. And yet you find yourself with a mother whose kids are now living in the United States and she's been separated from them. And so it's obviously a kind of lunatic notion to expect a mother just to abandon that trip and abandon her family because the enforcement policy was what it was at a moment in time. And so the U.S. government is only zeroing in on the U.S.-Mexico border as a place where they can treat people harshly enough to try to discourage them from making the trip. But that fails to understand the fact that large numbers of people, when they reach the U.S.-Mexico border, that is the final chapter in a much longer story.
And I think it is also related to this larger meta question that I wanted to ask you, which is, as we've been discussing, this is a longstanding, deeply entrenched political problem, human rights problem, and it is also incredibly complex and difficult to explain, which is why your book is so important. And you actually addressed this in that same interview that I was watching earlier this year. You said that it is intimidating to, quote, step into this history and find a narrative way into the broader story. But in your answer, there's actually a clue, which is that you made the decision to find a narrative way of stepping into the story, which is not the approach that everybody would take. And, you know, you've been illustrating that with the hospital scene that you played out for us and the story of Keldy. Why did you make that choice to take a character-driven, narrative-driven approach to telling this story?
You know, you can study this stuff. You can talk to experts. You can pore over, you know, legal documents and historical records, and all of them are revealing. But the most striking thing viscerally is that people have lived this broader history. People have lived out the consequences of some of these policy decisions, and people have lived them in ways that to them are very natural and matter of fact in the context of their own lives. And so that's always been for me the starting point in all of my writing and reporting on this subject, because in fact that's how I myself got educated on it. I mean, I met people who embodied different aspects of this history.
Yeah. Well, with that in mind, and in particular in light of what you said about certain people that you've met literally embodying the story, can you tell us where the title of the book comes from?
Yes, that's a phrase that Juan Ramagosa used with me in one of our conversations about a very specific moment in time. So in the early 2000s, there was a human rights case brought in a civil court in Florida against two ex-generals, Salvadoran ex-generals who've been allies of the United States, who had been relocated to Florida. And it turns out that in the early 2000s, a human rights group called the Center for Justice and Accountability in San Francisco got wind of the fact that these guys were living in Florida and brought a human rights case against them for crimes against humanity, which included, among other things, the systematic torture and incapacitation of Juan. And Juan displayed to me an almost superhuman strength in appearing in this courtroom. At a certain moment, a member of the jury passed a note to the judge. And the note said from this jury member, you know, I know we've seen all the evidence, I know we've heard all the testimony, but it would help before we go into deliberations to see the physical scars borne by the plaintiffs. And Juan steps in front of the jury box and rolls up his sleeve and starts to show his scars from this horrific torture he'd endured in 1980. And I asked him, you know, what it felt like at that moment. And he said to me, you know, I thought how lucky I was. I at least had scars I was able to show. I knew so many people who couldn't even be in the position that I'm in now. And it was in that context that he said this phrase to me, everyone who is gone is here. Everyone who had died, who hadn't survived, who couldn't make it to this point, they're here with me right now in this moment in the trial as I'm presenting my wounds. I'm bearing my wounds, but I'm really bearing all of our wounds. And that line, I mean, it gives me chills even to remember it now.
Yeah.
It just I realized that every aspect of this reporting over many years all led back to that fundamental principle and premise that those who are gone are still present, and that their story is our story in every sense.
Well, I've been talking to Jonathan Blitzer. Jonathan is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of the book we've been talking about, Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here, The United States and the Making of a Crisis. Jonathan, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, dining alone during the holidays isn't an ideal tradition, but it's what the next essayist has to do to survive the holidays in our series, Eating Christmas. But first, the Phoenix Police Department is facing down a scathing report from the Department of Justice that found they use excessive force and violate people's civil rights, especially people of color. Even before the report was released, city leaders spoke out against the idea of federal oversight. They say they're already making many of the reforms the government wants them to. But now that former President Donald Trump is about to enter a second term in the White House, there's speculation that his DOJ won't push the issue. And my next guest this morning says that would be a mistake. Andre Miller is the senior pastor and founder of New Beginnings Christian Church in Mesa, as well as vice president of the Arizona State NAACP. And over the last several years, he's become an outspoken community advocate for police accountability. But he told me he's not anti-police. In fact, one of his five sons is a police officer. I spoke with him more about how he got involved in this cause and what he thinks should happen next. And it's today's Deep Dive.
Many years ago, I had an incident in the city of Chandler. And when I had this incident in the city of Chandler, I'm a pastor in the community. I'm kind of connected. And I truly felt disrespected by a police officer. Mm. And I was like, if this is happening in the community, something needs to be done and someone has to say something. And so I had the resources and the connections to make a call to the chief like, hey, this happened. And so that triggered me like, hey, something needs to be done in our community. And so that's what got me going. Like, if I have a connection to the chief and can get something done, what about the people who don't? Hmm. So they need a voice. And so I began to speak out.
So you felt like you almost had a responsibility to say something?
Yes, absolutely.
You've spoken out about a lot of incidents with local police over the years, then since then, even sparked some investigations, made some changes. Tell us about the video that you gave to the former Mesa police chief and what happened in that situation.
So that's the Robert Johnson incident.
Yeah.
In that particular situation, I'm known in the community. Actually, at that time, I lived in that building. And the management company, they knew me as a community advocate, as a pastor. And they reached out to me right away. Hey, pastor, look at this video. Hmm. I said, well, let me record that. So I recorded the video. I sent it right to the chief. And he said, there's a problem here. And so that triggered a lot of questions. And it triggered internal investigations with the Mesa Police Department. Because that particular squad where that happened, they were not supervised the way they should have been. The video was not reviewed for the use of force. Like, none of the things that should have happened happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so that brought a lot of attention to some of the policies and procedures in the city of Mesa and the things that they were doing. And so they ended up breaking up that particular squad. People got various forms of punishment or what have you, retraining. And I think that's good for the community.
And there were some policy changes that came out of that.
Absolutely. And a lot of the policy changes, when you look at that, many times police unions or bargaining units or what have you, they are very resistant to change, especially if those changes are driven by the community.
Mm-hmm.
But I always explain that we're all the community. When you take off your uniform, you don't fly to Mars. I mean, you're still a part of the community, right? And so one of the things that happened was the chief of police at the time put in a memorandum about how officers cannot strike somebody in the face just because they're talking or what have you.
Hmm.
They have to actually show a sign of aggression. And that caused workman compensation claims to go down because officers now are not breaking their hands on people's faces.
Wow.
And my point was like, hey, a mouth is not a weapon. You're the consummate professional. So if somebody's calling you out your name, so what? You're getting paid as a police officer to be the professional. And my hope is that even with that, you know, it shows people that as a community, we can give input and it can actually be a good change for the agency as well.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the Phoenix Police Department, which has been hit pretty recently with a very sharp DOJ report saying that they use systemic discrimination, excessive force, particularly against minority communities. What's it been like for you from your point of view to watch that unfold? It's been bubbling up for a long time.
Yeah. So it has been bubbling up for a very long time. You know, even when you look at the George Floyd protest and how they were targeting people as gangs and, you know, all these various, you know, fraudulent charges, if you will, for people who were just exercising their right to free speech. Mm-hmm. The Phoenix Police Department, it does need oversight. And I know a lot of people are resistant to that, but it's hard for you inside the home to know that your gutter is hanging off the house, right? It's hard for you to sit in the living room, know that the grass is too high or what have you. And if people who are being affected by your agency are telling you there's a problem, you should want to listen and not just say, oh, we know how to police or our training handles X, Y, and Z, because apparently it does not.
So I wonder about that perspective, right? Because I wonder what you hear from the community itself. Like, you have become known as somebody who will make these connections, who will speak out on behalf of people who are feel like they are victims of police excessive use of force. Do people come to you now? Like, what do they say?
People come to me all of the time, whether it's a Facebook message, an email, they reach out to the church. I mean, people contact me all the time. And here's the caveat to that. When people contact me, I'm not just, okay, the police are wrong. I investigate, you know, like, let me go and request body cam footage. Let me go and request a police report. Let me see what this actually looks like. Because if we're wrong from a community standpoint, I'll tell us that too. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't just say the police are wrong in every incident.
And you have reason to believe this. You say you're not anti-police. You have five sons. One of them is a police officer.
Yeah, five sons and one is a police officer. So I'm definitely not anti-police, right? I am pro proper policing and what that looks like for our whole community. Everybody should be treated fairly and equally, right? You'll see, you can scour the internet right now and you can find incidents where a white person had an encounter with the police and they didn't get thrown on the ground, they didn't get yelled at, cussed at, or whatever the case may be. Could be the same situation for an African-American or a Hispanic person, and the call goes the total opposite way, right? These are things that we actually see in the community. Everything is not based off race, of course, but there are some people in these professions who have some animus because of race. And those are things that we need to make sure that we weed out of various agencies.
What does your son, who's the police officer, think about your work in this?
He tell me go all gas, no brakes. he likes the fact that I hold agencies accountable, and it makes it better for him, right? Police should not have an adversarial role when they come on the scene, right? I understand that they come into situations where they get to see the worst of humanity. I understand that. But when you come in, you're not a guardian or a gladiator. You know, you're a peace officer, and that should be what you show up as, a peace officer, a person who's trying to bring the peace, who's trying to de-escalate a situation, make sure that you go home as the officer and other people actually go home as well, or go to prison or go to the jail or whatever they need to go, right? But at the end of the day, a police encounter that's in a situation where it's avoidable, a person should not end up in a body bag.
You've also served as the first police chaplain for the Apache Junction Police Department. And in that role, you're there for the officers, right? Tell us a little bit about that perspective.
So I did that for a couple of years. I was the first appointed police chaplain for the Apache Junction Police Department. And most people were like, what do we need a chaplain for? What does that look like? And it's really like a pastor for the police and a bridge for the community. So I would go on calls where, you know, someone had expired and we had to kind of navigate what that looks like for a family. But it also puts a different perspective on officers, right? Mm-hmm. They're looking at somebody who's a part of the community who actually supports them. And me being the first black person, it was kind of a, you know, I'm sitting in the room and, you know, that's new for a lot of people in the room. But but I think it was a great thing for the chief to do at the time to make sure that people understand that, you know, the community is all of us. You know, you shouldn't just have comfort in people that look like you, right? Because you go out in the world, everybody doesn't look like you. You're going to come in contact with somebody who's black, brown, Asian, whatever the case may be. So it's very important that we find ourselves in those spaces. So I was glad to do it for a few years.
What did you hear from officers? What are their fears, their concerns? Do they want to be fair and equitable to folks?
I think so. But what happens is you find people who have been in the system for a very long time and they're very influential. So you can do all the training in the world that you want. You can have new officers come on the scene. But if they run into a sergeant who has a racial bias or animus, he's going to nurture that in new officers. And so that's why we have to make sure it's not just because, like, training now, I go to the academies often. I do question and answer sessions in academies, various academies in the Valley. And the issue is not really some of the newer officers, right? The people that are coming out now. It's people who've been a part of the system for 15, 20 years when things were okay to just hit somebody and, you know, it's a part of the job. And they're trying to change the force in various agencies and what that looks like. But when you have people who have these entrenched ideals, ideologies, and positions, it's really hard.
Okay, and we'll talk more about that and the latest controversy to hit the Phoenix Police Department in just a moment. That is Pastor Andre Miller, senior pastor and founder of New Beginnings Christian Church in Mesa, as well as vice president of the Arizona State NAACP. More of our conversation after the break. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. And let's return now to my conversation with Pastor Andre Miller with New Beginnings Christian Church in Mesa. He's also vice president of the Arizona State NAACP and has become an outspoken advocate for police accountability in the community.
Let me ask you about one of the latest controversies to hit the Phoenix Police Department, which is the case, of course, of Tyrone McAlpin, who is a black deaf man with cerebral palsy who was beaten and tased by officers. That body cam video became a big point, and it's still happening now. What was your reaction to that case? You were involved in that.
So I was the person who reached out to the county attorney to get the charges dismissed.
Yeah.
But I was the person who reached out and said, hey, there's a problem here. This does not look okay. And when you look at it, at the end of the day, it was a straight escalation when they made contact with him, right? There were a lot of things about this particular case that just were not okay. There's a certain form that they were supposed to fill out to say that he had these disabilities and he was differently abled. They didn't fill that out, right? So the judge is not even knowing that this person is deaf, this person has cerebral palsy, et cetera. Arizona, there are a lot of different cities and states you can see that will fire a police officer easily. Arizona is not one of those states. And I'm not saying people just need to lose their job for making a mistake, right? But when something's egregious, we need to make sure that we're setting a standard that this is not okay. And you don't just get a slap on the wrist and get to go out here and do it again.
So there is speculation now that the DOJ investigation into the Phoenix PD may go by the wayside under a Trump administration's Department of Justice. What do you think about that? Do you think that'll happen?
I think if that happens, it'd be a horrible thing. I think it would be an absolutely horrible thing if that happens. The issues that the Department of Justice raised are valid issues and valid concerns. That should be nonpartisan. The Department of Justice should not be utilized as a political arm or a partisan arm of an administration. So if there's an issue with a police agency, that needs to move forward. That oversight, those changes, recommendations, whatever it may be, those things need to remain. And it will be my hope that whomever is in charge of the DOJ does not, you know, go soft on these things, especially when the community is crying out.
I want to ask you lastly, Pastor, about your role as a pastor, right? Like, when you look at both sides of this, and you've seen both sides of it, you see it all the time with your son, right? I wonder where you think the gap is in understanding, like when you preach about this, what do you say?
So I preach Jesus. I tend not to get into my social advocacy from the pulpit. Some people do. I don't mm-hmm. do that. But when I speak to people outside of the pulpit, I explain to them, whether it be police agencies or civilians, at the end of the day, how we fix this, how we build this bridge is we communicate. We share with one another, and we're not so we don't operate in silos to where we don't communicate to the people that are being affected. Mm. Right. So if you're a police agency and people in the community are saying they're being policed harshly, you can't just say, no, they're not. If you're in the community, you're saying, well, we don't like the police in our neighborhood. OK, well, there are things going on in your neighborhood. The police have to be present, right, for you to be safe. There was a group of people saying abolish the police. Mm-hmm. And I told them, I said, that's fine. So if you abolish the police, okay, let's just say that's okay. If you abolish the police, if your cousin breaks in my home, take my TV, are you going to make them bring it back, fix whatever they broke? Are you going to do any of those things? Are you going to make them pay me for whatever damage they did? What do you mean? What do you mean what I mean? We live in a society where people do things that are wrong. And if somebody does something wrong, you want somebody to come and support you and make sure that you're safe. But you also don't want to be victimized by those same people in different settings. So that's kind of what I share every space that I find myself in. But across the pulpit, I just preach a way to be encouraged, edified, and know that you can have your best life in God. That's what I do across the pulpit. But in my community, in my advocacy space, I share the facts that we have to work together for this thing to get better. And you cannot deny what's glaringly apparent.
In that, though, I mean, there has to be a religious motivation for you.
The Bible gives us a mandate. The Bible says that I should love my neighbor as I love myself. And so when I see my neighbor hurting or harmed because I love them just like I love myself, it puts me in a position to speak up. And that's exactly what it is. I have to, my goal, I have five sons. My goal is to leave the world a better place than I found it. And so that's what I have to do. So as long as I'm able to speak to people in power and have conversations, I'll do that. As long as I'm able to, you know, stand on a corner and hold up a sign, I'll do that. I'll do whatever I can to make sure that communities are properly policed. The police understand that they are welcome, right, and that they are appreciated, but that everybody understands that in order for this world to be what we desire for it to be, we got to work together.
All right, we'll leave it there. Pastor Andre Miller, the senior pastor and founder of New Beginnings Christian Church in Mesa, also vice president of the Arizona State NAACP. Andre, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
A little more than a third of the country is experiencing some level of drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. The worst-hit areas include parts of Arizona, Utah, and California, as well as some regions of Texas. But areas in New Jersey, Delaware, and Massachusetts are also seeing extreme drought, and much of the East Coast is currently in a moderate drought. While this is somewhat new for those East Coasters, the West has been dealing with drought for years. But that's not the only difference between drought in the East and drought in the West. Andrea Thompson has written about this. She's an associate editor for Earth and the Environment at Scientific American. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about it, and they started with what some of those differences are.
So a lot of it comes down to there being kind of two different climates, the western half of the United States versus the eastern. The western is generally more arid. You have kind of a more distinct wet and dry season. So rain and snow tend to fall during a certain time period, generally from late fall into early spring. You know, if you don't get any rain or snow in that time period, by around April 1st, you're kind of done for the year. Whereas in the eastern half of the U.S., rains all the time, any month of the year. there's no distinct season for water. And that means that the way drought sort of happens is a little different. So in the West, water is really heavily managed. You have reservoirs, you know, like Meade, like Powell, some of the reservoirs in California. And those sort of trap the water that falls in the winter to be used throughout the spring and summer. And if you don't have enough come April 1st, you know, you kind of make these decisions about how much water to allocate, but you know, okay, we're going to be dry for the next few months. Whereas in the East, we have no idea. Is it going to be dry for the next 6 weeks, the next 3 months? There's not a lot of predictability there. And because of the way the climate is in the East, you know, we're in the middle, I'm in New York City, we're in the middle of a drought warning right now, the first in 20 years. It still rained some in the last couple of weeks, but we're still in a drought because we had enough of a period, 6 weeks, where we didn't have any rain that we just really started to tip into those dry conditions. The water reservoir that feeds New York City is much lower in capacity than it typically is. And so it can all just happen a lot faster in the eastern United States than it typically does out west.
Well, it almost sounds like even though the news might not be as good, it's almost easier to plan in the West than it is in the East for reduced water.
In some ways, because you sort of know, all right, at the beginning of the water year, this is how much we have. Here's how much you get. Here's how much you get. You know, obviously the problems come with the water system was sort of set up during an unusually wet climate period, which we are not in right now. So there's sort of more water allocated than actually exist, which is the problem. But in general, you know, if there was a better handle on those allocations, yeah, you'd kind of be able to do a little long-term planning because you'd know how much you started the dry season with. Whereas, you know, we don't know in the East, like, is it going to rain 10 days from now? Who knows? Because weather forecasts just aren't that precise that far out.
Well, it's like, you know, I grew up in New England and the old saw always was, if you don't like the weather right now, just wait a minute, it'll change.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we had a little gust, a snow squall that went through New York City briefly yesterday and then nothing.
Well, so I guess like that's sort of raises the issue of perception too, right? Like You know, if you walk around or drive around the West, like, you'll see riverbeds that are dry and have been for quite a while. But on the East Coast, like, there are streams and rivers and bodies of water that look perfectly healthy. And you're also in an area that isn't used to being in a drought situation or not having as much rain or snow or precipitation. So I wonder if the perception and just sort of the fact that this is so new in that area plays into this too.
I think that's definitely some of it. You know, the way I think people who live in the West are sort of used to thinking about water as a limited commodity to some extent, whereas that's just, you know, I grew up on the East Coast, lived here all my life, and, you know, it's just always there. You don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
Now, there have been droughts, certainly. There's a major drought of record from the 1960s in New England. There was a terrible drought in the Southeast in 2016, where there were wildfires in eastern Tennessee. So they do happen. It's just less of a thing that's sort of always on our minds in the south of the country. And there are places, so there are some reservoirs and some streams and stuff around the region that's currently impacted by drought, where they really are low down. If you see them, you'll notice there was in New Jersey a reservoir where a bridge from the 19th century, an old stone bridge, has sort of emerged because the water level has gone down so drastically. So there are sort of spots like that. But, you know, in New York City, you're looking out at like the Hudson and the East River, and you're not going to notice a difference there. Although I have noticed one thing, you know, going into some of the parks, it's really dry and dusty in a way it typically isn't.
So I'm wondering if some of these differences are affecting the way that policymakers are trying to deal with the fact that they're getting less water and maybe try to encourage residents to deal with the fact that they have less water.
Yeah, it's possible. It's interesting. So we're in a drought warning in New York City. There are various sort of levels of, you know, whether they call it a warning or have asked for water restrictions or things. It's very localized, or, you know, some of it could be at the state level, some of it's very local. There are some places in Massachusetts that are having to pour in water from somewhere else. I think if you probably ask the average person just walking down the street if they knew if we were in a drought warning, I don't know that many of them would, because I don't think you really, because all the restrictions are voluntary right now. And because it's not part of sort of the culture, I don't think people think about it.
I want to ask you about something that I know is an issue here in the West, which is, for example, when it hasn't rained for a long time and the ground is very hard and dry, that when it does rain, the ground's not able to absorb that water and a lot of it just runs off and can't really be used. Mm-hmm. Are parts of the East in that situation yet where it's been warm and dry enough where they're not able to absorb the rain or maybe even the snow, and you're sort of seeing, I don't want to call it waste, but you're not able to get that absorption level?
Yeah, I would say there are definitely spots. It's, I can't say super specifically, but you would particularly see that in places where there's been wildfire because of the way that kind of chars the ground and makes it harder for it to, even harder for it to absorb. Mm-hmm. So those would definitely be places where you'd have to watch for flash flooding, for less of that water to get absorbed. You know, I think if we had a serious downpour, and probably parts of these areas that are really in the deeper levels of drought, that, yeah, that would be a major concern, that it wouldn't, the ground wouldn't absorb it as readily as it might, you know, if this had been just a couple weeks into the dry period.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the ground, when there's a big downpour, the ground is not as good at absorbing that anyway. And when you add the extreme dryness, it just makes it even harder.
All right. That is Andrea Thompson, an associate editor for Earth and Environment at Scientific American. Andrea, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. For most of us, food provides comfort, particularly during the holiday season. But for some, it's the opposite. Audrey Trion explains in our next Eating Christmas essay.
Last year, I made Barefoot Contessa's lasagna for Christmas Eve dinner. I don't know what makes my mom prouder, the fact that I survived another Christmas, or the fact that I mentioned her Lord and Savior, Ina Garten. I say survive Christmas because it is not a day nor season spent in pure winter bliss. I doubt it is for most people. I try to remember everything I learned from the dealing with difficult people day in therapy when I'm confronted with questions like, so what job are you going to get with that degree? Or are you really going to eat all of that? I thank God that the difficult people are contained to only a few days out of the year. I can deal with a few days. What becomes harder to deal with is a lifetime of Christmas dinners spent alone in your room, dinners where laughs echo through the halls and fond memories are passed around and shared, but there you are, sitting in your room, pushing the food around on your plate. I spend my dinners alone in my room, not because my angsty teen days have somehow continued into my 20s. I spend my dinners alone in my room because I cannot be around the eating. I can cook and be in the kitchen, but it's my cue to retreat once people start to eat. My brain probably reacts quite differently than yours does to daily sounds like chewing, swallowing, repetitive noises, and more. Imagine that every time someone eats, clicks their pen, picks at their nails, even brushes their hair in your vicinity, you feel the blood rush through your veins, your muscles tense, your jaw clenches, and your brain conjures up thoughts so wretched that you wouldn't dare speak them into existence. Imagine this happening every day, multiple times a day. Every instance tattoos your brain and stays there, even for years. Family dinners live in a forgotten time. School lunch periods were spent smiling through the piercing noises of kids chewing, quite literally, like cows. And quick trips to the grocery store are ruined by passersby chewing gum. I have misophonia. If you have heard of it, you've probably heard the word annoyance as part of the definition. Misophonia is a condition in which one or more common sounds cause an atypical emotional response, such as disgust, distress, panic, or anger, in the affected person hearing the sound. Not annoyance. I have grown to detest the word as it describes misophonia. I am not annoyed by the sound of people eating or a fork scraping against teeth. I am disgusted and enraged, physically, psychologically, and emotionally sickened by it. I so deeply yearn for annoyance. It stings every time, closing the door behind me, wondering about the life I could have led if it hadn't been for misophonia. I developed misophonia at 11. Doctors still aren't sure what causes it. Some days it hurts so bad, I can't help but crumble alongside the agony of it all. Other days, I'm able to put on my headphones and eat my dinner. Yes, I am alone in my room, but at least I am not confronted with the poisonous sound of eating. So no, my Christmas is not spent in delight. It is spent with tears streaming down my face, panicked breath, and a crippling sense of isolation. But throughout the night, I play Scrabble against my parents, which usually ends with a victory in my name. I laugh with my sisters, hug my dogs, and cherish the day, my loved ones, and their never-ending understanding. Some years, it is harder to survive Christmas, but I always do. Who knows about this year, but deep underneath my skin, I will still be yearning for simple annoyance. Last year's lasagna was quite good, but I still ate it by my lonesome. That has become a fact of my life, meals alone, even on Christmas, whether I like it or not.
That was Audrey Treon. Check out more from the Eating Christmas series on our website, kjzz.org. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.